Welcome to Peak Tales, a conversation about chromatography. Now here's your host, John.
Hey, welcome back to the Peak Tales podcast. This is John. We're doing something a little different today. We're looking back into the vault and looking back at season one and presenting one of our most downloaded episodes called The Benchmarking of a New HPLC Column. It was with my friend Paul Altiero, or who I call Professor Paul. Take a listen. And at the end, we've got a special promo code for those of you who are loyal listeners. Take a listen and enjoy. Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Peak Tales podcast. And today we're going to be talking about benchmarking your HPLC column. I am joined today by Paul Altiero. Once again, Professor Paul is with us to talk about HPLC columns. Thank you for joining us again. What do we mean by benchmarking?
Hi, John. Thanks for having me again. And benchmarking columns, what we mean is we want a simple test to establish the initial performance capabilities of a column that we can refer back to during the life of the column to make sure that any challenges we're seeing in our analysis are or aren't due to the column. So a couple of things you should do when you first get a new column, right? And the obvious one is, you know, you flush your column, you run a couple blanks through it, things like that. But some of the other things you should do, read the checkout chromatogram. And early on in the checkout chromatogram, using the checkout chromatogram, you can calculate the column volume. So we normally estimate column volume is about 60% of the geometry of the cylinder. But you can calculate it. As an example, I was looking at a porous shell 4.6 by 50 millimeter HPHC18, and I see that my void marker, uracil, retention time is 0.302 minutes, and the checkout chromatogram was run at a flow rate of 1.4 mils per minute. So the time by the flow rate, the retention time by the flow rate, gives us the volume that was flown, that was flowed through that column, and it calculates out to about 422 microliters. That is a bit lower than the 500 microliters we would use as a standard estimate for that column. If you ran the volumetric calculation and took 60%, it would come out to be 498.
So there really is a difference between the calculated column volume and the measured column volume, but is it that significant?
Great question. It is a difference, and for the majority of the work we do, it's not going to be really very impactful. It will come into play, especially if you're doing method development, gradients, high throughput. Many of you might have heard some of the talks I've done, some of the webinars I've done on gradient method development. And in those cases, when we look at the gradient table, when we look at rather the scouting gradient, and we're looking at dialing in the percent organic where peaks start to come off the column, the difference in the system volume that we calculate versus what we measure can have an effect. So yes and no. I would say 90% of the time, 85% of the time, you could go at 500 microliters and that'd be fine. When you're really fine tuning, especially when you're looking for high throughput and gradients, it's impactful. And it's good to know. It's good to choose to round 422 to 500 instead of doing it inadvertently or accidentally. So after the column volume, you want to test the column. After you calculate the column volume, and by the way, when you calculate that column volume, write it down. Write it down on the checkout chromatogram. You're going to three-hole punch that thing, you're going to put it into a binder, and you're going to keep it. Now, the next thing you're going to do is run a naphthalene uracil test mix. You're going to look at the void time of the uracil again. You're going to look at the statistics, the peak statistics of the naphthalene. Now, the naphthalene, because it is retained, is going to potentially give you a different result than what you have on the checkout chromatogram, and that's going to be because your delay volume could be significantly different for the HPLC you're using compared to the optimized systems we use in the factory. The retention time of the uracil should be pretty darn close because it's unretained in both cases. The difference in the uracil retention time is going to be almost entirely due to difference in extra column volume. And if it's a significant percentage, it probably means you have too much tubing or tubing that is too long. But the uracil, we're going to look at things like the tailing factor, potentially the plate count. Now, the plate count can really differ depending on the configuration of the instrument. So I'm not overly concerned about matching that number. I do want it to be consistent within reason from new column to new column on the same system. But what I'm really interested in is the tailing factor of that peak, because the tailing factor will get worse as the life of the column starts to increase. More and more usage of the column potentially changes the stationary phase, the characteristics of the stationary phase. Other things get trapped onto the column. You start to see more and more tailing. So it's really good to have benchmarked with naphthalene and confirmed that you have a very, very similar tailing factor or peak symmetry as the checkout chromatogram.
So why specifically use uracil and naphthalene?
Thanks. Good question. Nothing specific about them. The reason I choose them is that is what we use for our checkout mix. Uracil is a standard void marker for C18, and naphthalene has very good retention on a C18. If you have other compounds that are good for void markers and have good retention, absolutely you can use them. If you're using a different type of column, I should have prefaced this, predominantly here talking with the example of a C18, like the HPH C18 I mentioned earlier. If you're using columns that have different chemistries, if you're using a phenylhexyl or a PFP and you're looking at pi bonding instead of lipophilicity, you might want to use a different marker. Ideally, I like to use the void marker and the retention marker that are used in the checkout. So it's nothing special about it. It's just something we've already used.
Certainly makes sense.
So after you do an injection with uracil and naphthalene, which matches what the checkout chromatogram was run with, you then want to inject something that's much more applicable to your own lab and your own analysis. And in that case, what I like to recommend is either a control sample or an internal standard sample. So many, many years ago, I ran a quality control lab, and we had production control samples. We used them in all of our sequences as controls to make sure that the instruments were behaving properly. And whenever we got new columns, we would shoot multiple injections on those new columns to also make sure the column was behaving correctly. So we would shoot a couple control samples to establish a baseline for performance. Now, in my lab, we actually built statistical quality control charts. And so we would chart, in our particular case, we did area under the curve. But you could do area under the curve. You might do resolution if your issue is resolution of two challenging peaks. You might do tailing factor if you find that you're not challenged with resolution, but you do, over the course of time, see that your peak starts to tail. There are a couple different parameters you can chart, and you can chart more than one. But by charting these, you can always refer back and say, okay, I'm within one or two standard deviations of this running average, so everything is good. It also lets you in a running fashion, in a real-time fashion, evaluate the performance of the column. And what I mean by that is, what do you do with your benchmarking after you've established it? So you get a new column, you flush it, you run naphthalene uracil to compare those results to the checkout chromatogram. You then run your control sample, and you use that result to increase, to build upon your statistical quality control chart, or at a minimum, you three-hole punch the results and put them in your ring binder. So why do you do all this? You do all this because down the road, you are going to have issues with your analysis, right? I mean, all the time. It's just the nature of the beast. If you wear sneakers long enough, they're going to wear out, right? I mean, this is what happens. But you want to make sure when you're troubleshooting a system, if you have bad results, if you have results that are outside the range of acceptability, you have to start with the idea that there's something off, but it could be anywhere in the entire system. And the most effective way to troubleshoot that is by having concrete tests and measures to rule out what is not behaving poorly. And that's where the benchmarking comes in. If you have poor recoveries of sample, or you have, say, issues with peak shape or carryover in the detector, something like that, if you go back to your column performance and your column is performing well, you have a benchmark to measure it against, then you can say, okay, something else is going on, right? Many, many times people will call in, they'll say, oh, I have a problem with my column. You say, well, what's the problem? I'm not getting the answer I want. Okay, that is a problem. It's not necessarily with the column. What do you normally have as, say, a tailing factor? Well, I'm not sure. Well, what do you normally get as area under the curve when you inject your standard? I don't recall. Okay, benchmark these things. Have something to measure them against. It's very easy to do. And the best part is, if you're using control samples for your benchmarking, ideally, these are the control samples that you're mixing into your sequence table. And you're already doing this as part of a GLP sort of approach, right? You mix in your controls so that on the fly, you see that the entire system is working properly. And of course, you then take those control values and you feed them back into the statistical quality control chart, because that's a living document. It evolves, right? When you look at that chart, by the way, there are a couple things you want to look at. You want to look at, of course, you want to make sure your samples are within 2 or 3 standard deviations of the norm, but you also want to look for more subtle things. As an example, in the lab I ran, we had a rule that if 7 data points came in all above or all below the mean value, it initiated an investigation. Now, these were 7 points that were all within the standard deviation limit, but statistically, it's infinitely improbable that 7 in a row will be all above or all below the mean without something having changed. Okay, so if you catch that trend, even though you're within the standard deviation limit, if you catch that trend at that point, then whatever you do to fix it, it's never really varied out of a range that should put your product or your test results at risk. What else? When else do you check your column? Obviously, when troubleshooting, right? You put you may not have a new column. That's one of the things we do. We switch to a new column right away. You may not have a new column, but you may have a backup system. You may have a spare system. You put this column on a spare system. You inject your test sample again. Now, if it falls within the parameters, if the tailing factor improves and things like that, it's clearly not the column. If the tailing factor is off and it travels with the column, yes, it's probably the column. Again, you have the controls in your sequences, so that's a free one. The other thing is this. Many people, okay, I used to use columns until they were exhausted, right? When I did drug discovery, you know, we'd get a column in, we put it on our system. 2 days later, it had 1,200 injections on it, right? So I went through 2 and 3 columns a week. But many people don't. Many people have 1 or 2 LC systems, and they run multiple methods on them. You may run 50, 60 injections on a column, and then take it off the system and put it back into storage. And I do get calls where people say, well, I took a column out of storage, and I think there's something wrong with it. Well, how do you know? Well, I don't like the peak shape. How does it compare to previous peak shape? Well, you know, I can't find those old chromatograms. Okay, well, there you go. If you benchmark it and you have a nice little ring binder with those initial injections, when you take a column out of storage, you run a couple blanks to re-equilibrate everything, you shoot your control on it. If the chromatogram out of storage looks reasonable compared to the benchmark when you first got it, then you can feel safe running your samples on it. So I think that's pretty much benchmarking in a nutshell.
Wow. Thank you, Paul. One question, though, as I heard you explaining this, it seems like there's a lot of time involved here. And the old saying is time is money. So doesn't this increase the cost of the analysis that you're doing?
You would think it might, right? Because it is, time is money, and you're using up instrument time. The old adage I like to reply with is a stitch in time saves nine. And from my old days in drug discovery, I remember seeing colleagues queue up 600 sample runs and not test the instrument before they hit go and left for the day while things were running overnight. Now, in my case, in that case at least, they were compounds that weren't extremely expensive, right? But there was money involved and there was time involved. And let me tell you, when somebody comes in the next day and all of their results are unusable because they didn't check the performance of their instrument, you start to appreciate just how much time and money you lose by not doing this. Now, if you're someone who is doing, say, extractions, you know, you have some MAB or something that takes, you know, days and days and days to produce and clean and everything else, then the value of that sample you use can be extreme, right? So yes, time is money, but a stitch in time saves nine. So and let's be real here, okay? We are analytical chemists. It's not accidental that anal is right in the front of analytical chemistry, okay? Connect the dots, do your due diligence, don't make a costly mistake.
Okay, thanks, Paul. I appreciate you putting that in perspective for us. And this is a practice, I think, that anyone can start doing. So there's some details here. I get that. And that's the beauty of having a podcast. You can just go back and re-listen and take notes as Paul was explaining the different steps and the cadence of the things that you might do. If you need help in finding test mixes, Agilent can help you. With that, certainly you can contact your local Agilent representative or go to agilent.com for more information on that. But thank you for the discussion on benchmarking and why it is so important. And I am sure we're going to have you back, Paul, on another podcast here on Peak Tales. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, John. Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Paul, for sharing your wisdom with us today. As I mentioned, we are running a very special promo for our Peak Tales Season 2 listeners. If you would go and make a purchase with Agilent in the U.S. or Canada, you can utilize the promotion code 1599. So that's 1599. And you'll get the discount off of some of your purchase. Now, conditions do apply and there are limits. So you will have to check with your local sales rep. So that's all we have for now. And thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Peak Tales. For more information on what was discussed today, contact your local Agilent representative or go online to agilent.com.